Hey, welcome to Athlete on Fire. This is Scott Jones, your host, and today we are coming to you guys live from the big REI in downtown Denver. I met someone that I met on the trail almost exactly a year to date. She's a journalist, an adventure journalist. She travels, and she's an ultra runner, so she's got a lot of cool, interesting stories. She kind of fits the mold for exactly what I'm looking for. She's an athlete, entrepreneur, and a traveler, an adventurer. And we sat down in a noisy Starbucks downtown. I edited out a lot of the background noise, so it's not too crazy. And I hope you guys enjoy the show. If you guys are new to Athlete on Fire, go to athleteonfire.com. Go review us on iTunes. It helps us get our name out there a little bit more. And some of our other projects are becomingultra.com and freethetrainer.com, in case you did not know. But all I'm going to do today is step back and let you guys listen to this awesome interview. We went over so much stuff: how to get started in journalism, some rules for writing if you're telling your own stories, what her favorite pieces that she's written to date are, Copper Canyon in Mexico. She went down there to do a story on the Tarahumara. Just lots of cool stuff. So I'll step back. You guys enjoy the interview. Thanks a lot. All right, Scott Jones. Say your full name.
Morgan Tilton.
Isn't it Morgan Angela Tilton? Thank you, Facebook.
Yes, it is. That's Morgan Angela Tilton.
I never even finished my point.
Yeah, so maiden names.
Yeah, so I've been seeing your name, because whenever I see your name on Facebook, it's Morgan Angela Tilton. So in my head, it's like, I just have that stuck in my head.
That's really funny.
It's so weird.
So a lot of people are going to know my middle name now.
Yeah.
I guess it's a good idea.
Don't kill a president. It's recording now, by the way, just so I don't forget. I have the best conversations with people, and then the second say, okay, let's record, like there's a noticeable drop in energy and apprehension.
Absolutely.
It's like, oh my gosh. So what I've been doing with a lot of my online interviews is just sending them a message and saying, hey, right when you hop on, I'm recording. Just as long as you're cool with that. Most people are cool.
Rather than being like, oh, and I'm recording and announcing it.
Yeah, yeah. For sure. All right, so here with Morgan Tilton, not Morgan Angela Tilton. And I'll do a good intro before we get started, before this gets on there. But I just want to start with saying thanks. This is definitely unique. I don't do a lot of live interviews. When I first started, I did a lot because I thought it would be cool. And then I realized, oh, time is this resource that I need to save with the kids and everything. So I don't drive around town a lot, but I thought it would be really cool because your stories are really cool. It's kind of our one-year anniversary, really, from doing that. So I had a follow back because you've done so much in the last year. It's just crazy. And I'll tell the story how we met here in a second. But you have so many cool things coming up right now.
Yeah.
And you're a writer, so you're creative too, which I can definitely respect. I think writing is something that so many people want to do, but they just don't dive in, you know, whether they have a traditional background or not. You're an ultra runner. You love being active. You're a traveler. So we're going to talk about a lot of that stuff today. And of course, the goal is always just to inspire people. And the tagline, Athlete on Fire, is to bridge the gap between amazing athletes, adventurers, entrepreneurs, and everyone else. So we can kind of throw you into all three of those categories: athlete, adventurer, entrepreneur. So I'm going to tell a story really quick. We put on a race called Fear the Deer, Trail Half Marathon, and we coined it as like the hardest half marathon in the Front Range out here in Colorado. And it's hard. I don't know if it's hardest. It's pretty damn close.
Yeah.
And we always put on training runs. And for the training runs, I usually warm people up, and then I'll go run the route with people, and then I'll go with people that are struggling, and I'll go back up to the front, like if I'm fit enough to keep up. And then, so last year about this time, me and you just ended up being the same pace and like out in the middle of nowhere. So we hung out for like, I don't know, probably 5 or 6 miles or something.
Yeah.
And got to hang out and get to know you a little bit, and know a little bit what you're starting. And I knew you're from Telluride.
Yeah.
And I knew that that was one of the first trail runs you'd ever done with a group.
It was.
And
yeah.
And you're a good runner, which I noticed. I was like, she's keeping up. She's doing well. So all this stuff has passed, and then in the last year, our paths have crossed, especially digitally. You've worked and done some stuff with people that I work with, and you're friends with my wife, and I know you guys have done some stuff together. So I just wanted to circle back around and see what your last year's been like. So take us back to that first day that I met you, and then just start talking about this last year. What's been going on?
Wow, it's been a really big year. Do you want me to start with the trail running or the travel or
okay,
the writing?
So I kind of see you in three, this is the three parts. So you got the travel, but it ties in with the running and the riding. You got the running, mm-hmm. and that's probably your thing, but you talk about it a lot because it forms you, right?
Yeah.
And then you have the writing, which is everything, I would assume. It kind of, when you're a professional writer, freelance writer, like, everything's got to have a story to it. I would assume that's how you think.
Absolutely. Like, everything kind of ties in together, and that's really a piece of what inspired me when I first started freelance writing, which I started doing when I graduated from school, or about a year after. Okay. I dove right into my career in freelance writing, and I really wanted to make it sustainable. That was the central value. Just everything that I'm passionate about and that inspires me in my life influences what I write about, and then what I write about also then feeds back into what I love to do. So naturally, you're right, I have started to cover a lot of trail running topics in the last year, which has been super exciting. When I met you, I was training for the Leadville Marathon, and I had come to that trail run because I had met this professional athlete named Junko.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
She's sweet.
You know Junko?
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Well, give some background on her really quick, because I think people will be interested.
Well, so Junko is a really well-known runner in the Colorado community. She is a two-time breast cancer survivor and also a two-time lead woman. And she's run, like, I don't even know how many ultra marathons and how many 100-mile races. She just finished a 100-mile race in Patagonia. She's just an all-around inclusive and passionate and kind person. So she kind of took me under her wing. I didn't really know that there was such... I didn't know that there was a trail running community when I started trail running.
Yeah.
I started trail running because, as you mentioned, I'm from Southwest Colorado. I'm from Telluride. I'm also from outside of Durango, Colorado. So my dad's based in Telluride. My mom's in this little town called Bayfield.
Okay.
And I
Bayfield. Never heard of that.
Yep. Bayfield. It's just about 15 miles east of Durango on your way to Pagosa Springs and Wolf Creek.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. So I think what really triggered my desire to trail run was this longing and missing of the mountains. Living in the city has been really a wonderful experience for me. I moved up here to go to school, and I started my career here, and it's been an awesome hub to network. But I was just really craving to go running outside on trail. I had been on one. A friend took me on a trail run at the Matthews Winters Trailhead, and I absolutely suffered. It was like super exposed trail run in the middle of the summer heat, and it was 4 miles.
It's a rough summer run.
It was, yeah. And then about a year later, this was at the end of November of 2015. I decided I just wanted to focus on trail running and looked up races, found the Leadville Marathon, and it just enticed me because of the high elevation and having like high peak vistas, and it seemed like the greater the challenge, the more focus I would need to have to train.
You want something to like drive you so you have to train.
Yeah.
You want something you can just kind of half-ass it and go out, you know?
Yeah. And that for me was a really huge decision, because I knew if I committed that it would mean spending less time with my friends that I currently had, because... And also my significant other at the time, because none of them trail run.
Yeah.
So when I met Junko, I was so elated to spend time with her. And every weekend, I would just like follow her around to these different group trail runs. And I met a lot of people in the trail run community, got to know all these different groups. And by the time I reached the Leadville Marathon, I was pretty well trained, and I had a great time.
Yeah.
And then one thing led to another after that, and I started ultra running.
Nice. Okay, so were you living in Denver when you started this?
When I started my riding?
When you started running, when you started wanting to get up to the mountains and to the trails.
I was living in Denver when I started trail running.
Yeah.
I've always spent time in the mountains and on trails.
Yeah.
I just wasn't running. Like, growing up, I grew up hiking. Like, one of my first memories was learning how to hike as soon as I could walk, like with my dad. And
I mean, if you guys are listening and you're from somewhere else in the world, you could not get in a more beautiful and natural place with amazing mountains and sand. Yeah. Like Telluride, Durango, that little triangle right there is just
The San Juan Mountains are just absolutely magical. Telluride, to describe it, if you haven't seen photographs, it's in a box canyon. It's half a mile by a mile wide. So there's no way you can drive past it. You have to drive to it.
Yeah.
And the town sits at 8750, surrounded by 13,000 foot peaks. It's just unlike any other place I've ever been.
I remember I was there and they're having a, you probably know exactly what I'm talking about, this mushroom festival.
Yeah, there's mushroom festival.
What is the mushroom festival all about? I remember one, I was like, is this like a drug mushroom festival, or is this just like whatever?
You learn how to forage mushrooms and how to make sure that you find mushrooms that are not poisonous, and you learn how to cook them. And
have you ever been to that festival?
No, I haven't really been to the festival. I've gone mushroom hunting, but it's also something that I think you have to take with some seriousness. Like, you don't want to go and eat. You don't want to pick up mushrooms and eat them if they're poisonous.
Yeah,
so,
PSA here, everybody.
Yeah, so, like, I've done some mushroom hunting with my dad, but he's not an expert, so we didn't really do it a lot.
It's scary. I mean, some mushrooms will destroy you. Like, you'll get so sick. I'm from the East Coast, and I went to college in Appalachian State, which is Boone, which is I always describe as, like, East Coast Boulder, but hillier, you know? And then I went to the small college in West Virginia, and, I mean, they have, like, wild onions and wild rhubarb.
Yeah.
You know, they have all these festivals for different things that grow wild.
Oh, yeah.
And mushrooms were huge out there, but I was too scared. I didn't have the time to get the base knowledge.
Right.
And I was trying to be sick. Because you would just see wild, I mean, just the craziest colors. And some stuff was edible and some stuff
was not.
But mushrooms are crazy right now because they're kind of making, I don't know if it's a comeback, but, like, they're using it for coffee and for supplements. And there's a huge, like, industry.
Yeah, obviously. There's a lot of medical research going on with mushrooms right now, too.
And you gotta find a lot of poop, man. You gotta dig around in cow poop. What's up
with that? Not in the high mountains. You gotta go up.
I know a lot of mushrooms are in poop.
Go up to my peaks.
All right, so Telluride, Durango, you kind of had your family out there, and you're going to school. You're going to school in Denver?
I was.
Okay.
I went to the University of Denver for my undergrad. And
what'd you study?
And then I studied journalism, English with a focus in creative writing, and Italian. So I did 3 degrees in 4 years.
Journalism with English and Italian?
English, creative writing, and Italian.
Nice. That's an interesting mix, dude. So the Italian was the romantic in you, I'm assuming. Like, who goes and gets a degree in Italian? Were you planning on moving to Italy and writing about wine? I mean, what was the goal there?
Italy was where my passion for international travel was born.
Was it?
Yeah.
Oh, nice.
When I was in high school, I had an opportunity to travel to Italy and Greece on an EF Tours trip. One of my teachers at school was the leader and a chaperone for this trip, so it's a really affordable and accessible way for young kids to go abroad. And both of my parents, they were both active when I was growing up, and we traveled a bit.
Yeah.
But we would always kind of go back to the same places. Like, with my dad, I would go to Lake Powell, and with my mom, I'd go to Tucson and spend time on a dude ranch with her family. And so for me to have a way... It was like a way for me to pitch my parents to let me go travel abroad.
That's cool.
And also at an affordable cost that I could pay for. So I spent like my childhood life savings, $1,200, on this trip to Italy, and totally fell in love with the history and the sound of the language. So beautiful, and the landscape. So that, after that experience, I was determined I wanted to go back and I wanted to learn the language, and that led to how I chose my school. I went to college. I chose DU because it was the second best university for study abroad in the country. And they send, at least when I went to school, they send like 80% of students abroad because...
Oh, wow.
Yeah. That's because of their junior year. They pay for the round-trip air flight. They make sure that all of your credits are transferable. So it was a way for me to... pursue my dream and also go to
school. So did you get a semester over there? Or?
It was, altogether, it was about a semester. I actually ended up doing two trips during school.
Nice.
So I did the semester, but I extended my stay. I actually went 2 weeks early, and my dad went with me.
Oh, no way.
And we went backpacking. It was like our first father-daughter solo trip and his first time in Italy, and that was incredible. Just what a way to get my feet wet.
Yeah.
And then after I finished my study abroad, I came back here to the U.S. for like 6 months. And then I went back to Italy and went to a different region on the southeast coast. And I worked for 6 weeks, like four different jobs.
Oh, wow.
And I was totally remote at that point. So that's when my language skills actually skyrocketed.
Yeah. I mean, immersion is crazy. Mm-hmm. It's crazy. You know, like, we traveled in South America a couple times, and we took class. Like, we would take Spanish classes and stuff. And so you were there, you know, after a couple weeks, you just reel off a couple sentences. You're like, what in the heck? You know, your brain finally just triggers. It's like training.
Yeah.
It's just really cool.
And then you start dreaming in the language. And,
I haven't done that
and
yet.
Then you realize what you're talking about. You're able to talk about politics, and you're able to talk about emotions and relationships, not just, hi, how are you, what do you do?
Yeah.
Yeah, you start to have depth. And
there's that, and you know way more about this than I do, but it just seems like there's this point when you're not translating anymore in your head.
Yeah.
Like when that word owns the meaning instead of, for Spanish, like C, instead of C meaning yes every single time. You know, for me, instead of when somebody says they run a 5K, I have to do the math really quick to get to miles. Instead of having that translation every single time. How long does it take to get to that point when the words just start owning the meaning? A while?
I don't think that it's really based off of a timeline.
Yeah.
It's more like the experiences that fill your time. Because I spent 3 years studying the language in a classroom, writing, listening, and not really getting too much opportunity to speak.
Yeah.
And I did fairly well in my classes, but when I went to Italy and started taking class from an Italian teacher in Italy, I was failing. I had to work my ass off for like the first time in my life.
Yeah.
Like, or not the first time in my life to work really hard, but that I was failing at a class. And I decided that I really needed to, even though it scared me, put myself out there and go and meet Italians and spend time with Italians and learn from them. And that then turned around my ability to speak. Just having a space where I could actually speak. And you kind of just have to ignore all of your fears and premonitions.
Yeah.
And just
scary.
Like, yeah. Yeah.
I mean, you're looking like an ass.
You have to make mistakes. You have to accept that you're not perfect.
Yeah.
And start making mistakes so that you can grow. Yeah. Yeah.
I've been through that a lot. We honeymooned in Southeast Asia, and just trying to say hi or thank you, half the time, the simplest words, nothing. It's a guttural language. It's like nothing's happening. Okay, so your love of Italy was born from a trip that you took when you were young.
Yeah.
I have a couple more questions about Italy, but where did your love of writing come from?
That's almost always been a part of who I am as a person. Since I was a little kid, I remember that my mom used to read to my brother and I when we were really young, and by the time we started kindergarten, we were already at like a second grade level.
Yeah.
We were just well ahead of, because we started reading with her. And then I started creative writing when I was a little kid, and I remember just doing competitions, and my teachers and my local community really applauded me and encouraged me to keep writing, and I pursued it.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then I just fell in love with it.
And you write... Sorry, go ahead.
When I got back from that first trip in Italy, something clicked for me. I was only like 15 years old, but I remember being in my dad's house and seeing like a Condé Nast, like travel magazines, and opening them up and being like, wow, like this is the type of writing I want to do. I just like my trip to Italy and all the journals that I was keeping about all of the like architecture I was learning about and the artists like and the food. I want to go to fascinating places, beautiful landscapes, learn about them and bring that information back to where I'm from and inspire other people to go and explore. And it just clicked in that way. I didn't know exactly what the path would be or how I would evolve or how to get there or how to seek mentorship, but I just got this little seed of an idea and here I am 10 years later.
How old are you?
26.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's really cool. Okay. So there's three things that kind of encompass you. I'm going to dive into each one of them a little more specifically. Okay.
Yeah.
The traveling, we'll put that at the end because it's so big. And if I start talking travel, we'll be here all day. Like, it's just, you know how it is. Like, you start going into a rabbit hole. So let's talk about the ultra running. Because you went from having an idea, doing level, which is it's pretty tough marathon. I've done it before. It's not easy. And then going into ultra. So what was your first ultra after Leadville?
It was a few weeks later.
Oh, really? Holy crap. So wait, I saw you in spring last year.
Yeah.
Well, Leadville's what? It's in July?
June.
Is it June? Okay. So you did the marathon in June.
So I did the marathon in June, and it went really well. I loved it. And so 5 days later, I did the Leadville camp.
Oh, did you say 5 days later?
Yeah.
Okay.
Like 5 days later, which the first day of running, you run 26 miles. So it was basically running the same amount. No, I felt great.
Did you really? Nice.
Yeah. I mean, this is not. It's so funny when I talk to friends, and one of the most popular questions that they ask is, what do you do for training? How far do you run? Well, that is a part of training for me, but it's also like only half of training for me.
Yeah.
I don't know what elite athletes do or even, you know, recreational athletes do, but I do need to stretch a lot and work on my mobility.
Oh, yeah.
So I do a lot of recovery in order to feel good while I'm running.
Yeah.
So it's not, I'm not like an alien. I felt good during the camp because I was keeping up with what I need to do to keep my body well oiled. So lots of like foam rolling and stretching.
Yeah.
And I am like super grateful that I came out like just feeling really healthy and strong. So the camp was a bridge for me mentally.
Okay.
I told you I had met Junco and met a lot of trail runners through Junco. The camp was this really saturated group of ultra runners. Most of them were running the Leadville 100.
Okay.
Some of them were running Run Rabbit Run 100, and then only a handful were not signed up for a race. I was one of them included. I was thinking about signing up for Silver Rush, which is the 50-mile race in the Leadville series, which I learned about from Junco because she was racing it. And she had also, I don't know if it was her that encouraged me to do the camp. I think it was some other runners. Regardless, I ended up just feeling very much at home in this tribe.
Yeah.
And for the first time, I was totally surrounded by people that met my ideas with a sense of normalcy. It wasn't something that was, quote, crazy to want to run 30 miles in the mountains in a day. I went through the running series, which was 3 days. And the first day we did a 26-mile run, and you're following the course of the Leadville 100.
Okay, so just doing sections.
Yep.
Okay.
And then the second day we did Hope Pass, which is a 20-mile run.
Nice.
And then the next day we did a night run around Torquay's Lake.
Nice.
And I made some incredible friends that are probably going to be lifelong friends. I ended up pacing one of my good friends, Tim Barr, in the Leadville 100 last year, and now he's pacing me this year.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
nice.
In Leadville 100. So,
how many people were at the camp? How big was it?
I think it was about 150 people.
Oh, wow. That's
yeah.
pretty big.
I actually just wrote a story about this experience.
Oh, did you really?
Yeah.
Is it out?
Essay. It's coming out in June in
okay.
print in Elevation Outdoors magazine.
Nice.
So check it out.
Okay, I will.
Yeah.
Elevation Outdoors.
Yes.
What is the website for? Because is it just elevationoutdoors.com?
Yep.
Okay.
I think that's the URL.
They're a local publication, but they are online. And I know they have partners back east for other similar publications, don't they? Like Blue, I think they do like a Blue Ridge version. And
yeah, yes.
I think. Anyway.
I'm not exactly sure what their partnerships are
yeah,
now.
That's okay. Yeah. I'll put the link in the show notes, though, for sure.
Thank you. Awesome. So yeah, after the camp, I was inspired by the people around me and also had gained confidence in what my body and my mind were capable of.
Yeah.
And I signed up for the 50 the day after the camp finished.
Yeah, nice.
And I had a great time. I came into that race with some obstacles for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Physically?
They were circumstantial and physical. So I made a little bit of a mistake with training. I decided to go on a backpacking trip 6 days before.
Ooh. Oops.
And my hamstrings got super tight. I didn't realize how much elevation gain the trail had.
Where'd you go?
I was backpacking solo. I was down in the Sangre de Cristos, and
yeah.
I went down there to meet some friends. So I came late. So I was carrying, like, everything I needed in my pack. It wasn't
wow.
like I got to divide the weight with my friends. And I also, there was a huge rainstorm on the drive down. It's like 5 hours away.
Yeah.
So by the time I got there was all this flooding. And yeah, and I basically, it took me a lot longer to get there, and it got dark before I got there, and I had to just, well, I eventually had to just set up camp solo. So, anyways, it put a lot of pressure on my hamstrings, and then with the long drive back, my body just sets up like cement, so I couldn't shake that from my legs. And on the drive up to pick up my bib on the Friday night before the race, my car broke down on I-70.
Oh my gosh.
Which was like the scariest, most stressful experience ever. If you're going 70 miles an hour and your car just stops, and there's hardly even a shoulder.
Where were you?
I was outside of Idaho Springs.
Oh, yeah.
So I wasn't even
starting
that far.
To climb a little bit.
Yeah, starting
yeah.
to climb. And it's like 85 degrees out. And so fortunately, there was someone patrolling, and he came and stopped and pulled my car off the road with his truck. But what I later found out, a week later, I had to have my car towed back to Denver in order to make it to the race. And a friend came back from Leadville to pick me up.
Oh, my gosh.
Which was...
So you're sitting in the car for the extra time?
Huh?
So you're sitting around in the car again for extra time?
Right. Yeah. But I was like, this experience just stressed me out so much. And I'm a big believer that, like, stress changes the way I feel, way my muscles feel. And just going through that stressful experience on top of tight hamstrings the next morning, let's just say my hamstrings were really tight, and I had IT band pain for 50 miles.
It's the worst.
But mentally, I was really happy. So
yeah.
It was this like crazy paradox of a run. But side note, really quickly, what was wrong with my car was that there's this chip reader inside the steering wheel that like basically shuts down the engine if the car's being broken into, and that failed.
What?
Yes.
That's
so it
crazy.
Stopped the car from running while I was driving.
It just totally did it like like slam it on the brake stop?
The engine just goes whoa.
Oh my gosh.
And wouldn't
That's
yeah.
scary, dude. At least there wasn't like was there anybody behind you? Hopefully not.
There were people behind me. But thankfully I just like pulled off the road really quickly. So that's what led me into my 50 mile, and let's just say by the time I got there, even though physically I was so in pain, I was so grateful and happy to be running.
Yeah, no, I hear you.
Like I actually
That's
made it.
That's the good
it.
Part, right?
Yeah.
That's the good part. No, well, it's funny because I'm doing the timeline. April-ish, saw you on the trail.
Yes.
And Leadville's in a couple months after that.
Yes, and then the Silver Rush was in July.
So that's a month after Leadville.
Oh, that's the other thing about Silver Rush 50. So
yeah.
I have to add this. it was going to be a way for me to get into ultra running. It was my first ultra distance I had ever run. Okay. I hadn't run over 26 miles, even in training. But I was excited to go do a race because of the energy and also because a couple of friends in camp planted this idea in my mind that it would... It was a way for me to get a gold coin to qualify for level 100.
Ah, there you go.
And
you threw it in there already.
Yeah. And so you could either get a gold coin by standing on the podium at the end. If you got first place, you get a gold coin. And if that person says, oh, I don't want it, then it rolls down to the next person and so forth. Or there's this really evil way you can get a gold coin. You can get a gold coin in the Silver Rush if you sprint the ski hill at the beginning.
Really? I've never heard this.
Yeah. I think it's called Dutch Henry Hill or Henry Dutch Hill. Either way. And it's this super steep, super rocky, just not something you want to start an ultra run by doing. And the first woman and the first man to the top get a gold coin. So I walked it a couple of times the night before just to, like, get an idea of, okay, this is when the suffering's going to start.
So you sprinted
and
it.
I sprinted it and got the gold coin.
Boom. We're fist bumping. How far was that?
That is, like...
a quarter mile or something?
Yeah, something like that. Oh. Yeah, I don't...
So, like, you want to...
If somebody knows in the audience, tell me.
So you want to vomit after the first quarter mile. Oh my gosh, that's awesome. So then, but you have to still finish. You still have to finish, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. You still have to finish the race.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which was my goal all along. I mean, that was like the overall number one goal. And then I was also thought it would be fun if, and yeah, thought it would be fun to
were
get the
you,
level
were you able to get, like, so for the IT band stuff, when you're walking, you're fine. For me, when I've had IT band issues,
yeah,
it's when you start opening up a little bit, when it starts flaring up a bit. Or was it just kind of aching all the time?
You know, it was like my hamstrings were really, really tight.
Yeah.
And then after 30 miles, it moved into my IT bands.
Yeah.
And I didn't realize I was also cramping until someone offered me some salt pills.
Yeah.
And I took a few of those and realized how relieved my muscles were.
Yeah.
So I was also just low on... nutritionally on some needs. Yeah,
that's usually the X factor for me for a high altitude long efforts. Mm-hmm. It's just electrolytes, food, it's whatever. I can put whatever I want in my body. I'm usually pretty good.
Yeah,
hydration usually pretty good, but gotta keep the salt coming in for me, because I just sweat a lot. Like,
totally.
It's just a huge, but everybody's gotta figure it out at high altitude for sure.
Yeah, so...
So you do the 50, and then what? Do you do 100 the next weekend, or...?
then I had some exciting races to finish off the year that I just really loved. I got to do Imogene.
That's fun.
Down in Telluride, and that was so special.
So I've done that before. That's got to be special because it's your hometown, right? Your stomping grounds. But this... I have a great story for this race. I'll share a little bit part of it. But set the table for this race. It's a 17 point something?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a weird distance. Like 17.2, I don't know.
Yeah.
And basically, you go up for 10 miles, and then you bomb it.
Yep.
Miles. But paint a little more of a picture, because it's really cool.
So a lot of people will take the bus over in the morning at like 5 a.m. from Telluride over to Ouray. To the other side of the pass, and then you start running from Ouray, and you run. This actually could be arguably one of the hardest races I've ever done, because it's relentlessly uphill, and you climb somewhere around 4,500 feet, I believe.
I think it's more than that.
Is it 6,000?
Six or seven.
I'm getting my numbers mixed, but I think it's somewhere around 6,000 feet. Probably.
And it's crazy because...
And you go up to between 1,200 and 1,300 feet.
Yeah, you're right on.
So you're really exposed by the time you get to the top. And it gets super steep. Like, I remember that last mile being really tough. Like, my legs were just suffering. But, okay, what's so cool about this race is you're, like, looking around and you see so many Coloradans.
Yeah.
There's just such a local vibe and local presence, and a lot of them are a lot of locals from the area, and it's like a walk in the park for them, which for me is super inspiring to see a 75-year-old woman who is a Telluride local who's beating me up the last half mile.
That's so humbling. It's ridiculous. And the old dudes get out there and just smoke you.
Yeah.
It happens all the time.
Yeah. And then they're serving some soup at the top. You get your little cup soup real quick.
It's usually freezing up there.
Fortunately, we had like blue skies and sun. And then, you run downhill. And it's this incredible canyon that you're running down through the other side. And you come out to the street right off of Main Street in Telluride. And it's just lined with all these people cheering you on. And the other pretty interesting piece about imaging that I noticed is there's a ton of Flagstaff runners that come out to it.
Oh, really?
And yep.
Nice.
And they do really well.
Yeah.
I mean, they're like getting some of the top spots in all age categories. And this year, I think I remember them announcing like over 100 Flagstaffers.
Wow.
It's a really impressive number.
That's cool.
For them to come from like Arizona to super like high elevation. Because we're talking,
it's crazy.
Yeah, 13,000.
It's like 6 or 7 to 13. It's nuts.
Yeah.
A lot of those Flagstaffers, though, they go down to Grand Canyon and get some of those crazy climbs. So that climb isn't that tough for them, you know?
No, totally. They get the elevation change, but the altitude is what always surprises me. Like, when I hear about, especially even more so with, like, Midwesterners that come out and do level 100, or not even from, Midwest, but just low altitude from all over the world will come and do level 100, and they've never been at high altitude.
They do fine.
Yeah.
Hey, I mean, the acclimation takes... Well, some of them, everybody does fine. I always tell a story of this guy that we met when we were doing level marathon. He was so nervous that he was going to crash and burn. But his training was great. He had a great aerobic base. He literally trained on, like, this 100-foot mile-long climb. That's nothing here, you know? And he killed it. Like, so many of these people said... It shouldn't be a deterrent by any means, but...
For sure.
But you're
absolutely. I just think, for me personally, if I had never been at altitude, I would be really curious how my body would respond to it. Just because there's so much that's written about it.
Yeah.
But I also recognize that it may not be... It's not the end all for your training.
No.
If you sign up for a race with altitude and you're not exposed to it. It's also just so much about how hard you train, really.
Yeah.
And
you get anaerobic at imaging, for sure. It's not like going jogging for 4 hours. You are anaerobic from, like, the get-go. Well, if you guys look it up, I'm drawing a picture on my paper. Anyway, if you look up imaging, like, Urey's Box Canyon, it's like, isn't it the hub for ice climbing in North America?
So it is.
Ice climbing hub. And then you go over this crazy canyon, over a 13er, into another box canyon.
Yes.
And it's probably the roughest way to get from Urey to Telluride. But I think it was a huge mining area. Like, those roads that we run were all mined out, which is how they're there, I think.
Yes, that's a great summary. Yep, Tomboy Road is up to the old town of Tomboy, and there's huge mining history down there. And you have at the top of Bridal Veil the... there's a house, and it's the old like hydroelectric plant.
Oh my
gosh. That's another really iconic piece.
You just try to imagine how people were living at that altitude back in the day, because they'd set up camp there for months, you know.
It's
wild.
And get snowed in, and
there's you guys gotta look at pictures, because some of the drop offs on that run are just phenomenal.
Oh yeah, it's incredible. It fills me with so much joy.
And then when you get to the top, your legs are cashed because you've been climbing.
Yep.
It's an evil run, because in the beginning it looks really runnable. And it's really not. I mean, but it's not. You're redlining really quick.
Yeah.
And then you just have, your legs are cashed. You're just so happy to start going downhill. And then the goal is, can I run 7 miles? Because your legs are so tired. And you want to keep a good pace. And then you come in and you go eat like 2 pizzas by yourself. It's great.
I think one of the hardest parts for me on the downhill was that there were some spots that were really actually flat. They flatten out and they were exposed. And at that point, because I don't run as well in heat, that's when I really started to suffer. Was more
warmer
so than the climbing. Because in the climbing, it was still in the shade and it was still cold.
You and my wife, you guys would rather climb for like 6 hours if you're in the shade than like have an awesome downhill.
Yeah.
It's unbelievable. Anyway.
Yeah.
So, okay, so, Imogene, that's
so
in September.
Imogene. And then yeah. 2 weeks later was like the best and craziest run ever. I signed up for the North Face Endurance Marathon in Park City. I signed up for it and pretty much just, I don't want to say like I figured it out as I went, but I mean, just a lot of pieces had to randomly fall into place. Like, I found a friend of a friend to stay with. I also had a work invitation to go to Bryce Canyon the 3 days leading up to the race with REI to go and test out their backpacking gear.
Nice.
So I was like emailing with them and just like asking, okay, what kind of a gear am I testing out so I could get an idea of how much weight I'd be carrying so I didn't make the same mistake again.
Yeah.
So they were like, oh no, like it's just gonna be light, like we'll have other people carrying the food. And so I knew it was going to be a lightweight pack and that I'd be able to go and hike around and have a great time. So I did that trip, and I literally had to like fly to Las Vegas, which was like the nemesis of travel for me. I don't like traveling in Las Vegas. Spent about 12 hours there, and then immediately got in a car and drove up to Bryce. Backpacked for 3 days, but it was like apocalyptic weather. It was
in the fall.
It was, yeah, so yeah. Last September. And there was huge storms that hit, and a lot of the trails shut down. It was super muddy, super rainy, super foggy. Fortunately, after like 2 days of backpacking, the clouds opened up and we got to actually see the park. But we had no cell phone reception. And by the time we come out and we're driving back to Las Vegas to catch our flights, and I was flying directly to Park City for my race the next day. Yeah,
you need to figure out this pre-race stuff.
Oh, I actually think this set me up really well.
Yeah.
Yeah, this time it worked.
Okay.
So as we're driving out of Bryce Canyon, we look up the news and there were like hurricanes that had touched down. That's how crazy the weather was.
Oh,
like,
my gosh.
It wasn't just that like our tents were getting ripped out of the ground, but literally there were tornadoes that were next to us. So that was just a funny piece of news. And also we were grateful that we weren't in the middle of the tornado. So then also my phone had broken at this point because of all the rain. And so I had no phone. And I'm going to meet up with my friend of a friend. I've never been to her house.
Oh,
I don't.
Gosh.
I haven't driven around Salt Lake City by myself. So I get to the airport, open up my laptop, and old school style, write down the directions to her house on a piece of paper.
You're 26. You've probably never done that before.
I had done it. I didn't have a cell phone yet when I started driving when I was 16. But it was just this like blast from a past of, okay, I got to trust that what I'm writing down, I can follow the directions.
That's so funny.
And I email her. I'm like, hey, I'm at the airport. My phone's broken, by the way. I'm going to try to find your house. I follow the directions, and I get to the street in Park City. I'm driving back and forth. Can't find her house number. And I'm like, okay, just gotta keep stress at bay. Don't get stressed. Those hammies are gonna get tight if I get stressed. So I can't find the house number, so I go and knock on someone's door and ask for their help.
That's awesome.
And they give me some advice, and they're like, okay, it's gotta be one of these two houses. Turns out one of the numbers had been switched when my friend had sent me the address.
Oh my gosh.
So I just finally drove up the driveway, knocked on this random door, and it was their house, and she had made dinner for me. It was like the sweetest welcome party. The next day, this was super special. That ended up being super special that I didn't have a cell phone, because I run the race. It goes incredibly well. Like, I'm just super happy. They had to reroute the course because of the weather, but for my race, it just meant that we did two laps.
Oh, cool.
We just didn't go as high up on the ski resort. For the 50-milers, it was a little more painful. They had to do four laps of the same route, and they were kind of irritated.
I think I remember reading something about that. Yeah.
It was super muddy, super cool, beautiful, like, yellow foliage with white clouds, and I was just so happy all day. Ended up coming in, like, 10th overall. Did really well.
Nice.
Felt really well. And I'm walking around the race afterwards, and my friend that I had been staying with shows up.
Yeah.
And it just meant that much more because I hadn't had a cell phone. Like, yeah. She, like, found me, and all the relationships that I made that day were just very much in the present without me. Like, on one hand, I really wanted to share what the race had been like with my family and with my friends back at home. But on the other hand, it was like I got to get to know a lot of other people because of that.
Yeah, it's huge, man. Turning off or leaving it behind every once in a while.
Yeah.
It's a good thing.
Yeah.
Me and Lauren just went to San Diego, Estonia, and we're trying to put it down for our runs and trying to put it down for some stuff we're doing just so you can connect. Like, there's just so many people, like, everybody's on a phone in here, you know?
Yeah.
This is cool.
It's definitely
awesome. Park City's beautiful, too. I've never run up there, but I've been there a couple times, just driving through. It's always like emerald green.
It's so
really
pretty.
Green up there.
Yeah.
It's cool.
Park City's awesome.
Well, what distance was that one? Marathon?
That was marathon.
Trail marathon?
Yep. Cool. So about, it was actually really similar to Leadville as far as elevation gain and distance.
Yeah. So you said you stretch and you foam roll and all that. Do you attribute being able to stay healthy with such a quick ramp up to your non-running prep and prehab, if you will?
I do. I don't think that I could. I don't think I can just run.
Yeah.
And it does. I also do strength training.
Yeah.
That's really important for me, and it needs to be strength training. I do some targeted weightlifting, but mostly I do high intensity interval training at this location called Manic Training, which is for mountain athletes. I mean, there are a few different, you know, business models and training models like this. And Manic, I became involved with them because I wrote a story about them when they opened here it was in the fall of 2015. A friend of mine used to live in Steamboat, and that's where Manic Training was founded. So when they opened up a location here, my friend told me, hey, you should go check them out. Yeah. You should try it and write a story about it because it really works. So I started going to them and wrote a feature about what they're up to, and I got pretty hooked on it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just from doing the workouts and trying it out?
Sorry?
Just from trying the workouts and joining in?
Yeah, and just, I guess, with the community and what they offer. It's this mentality of, you know, being ready for life and being prepared as a mountain athlete and also as someone who has a family. Like, you want to, for moms and dads that just want to be able to run around with their kids. So it's really accessible for anyone. And it's also very much, like, the people that I interviewed that do this are, like, going and summiting Everest.
Oh, wow.
And they're professional athletes that swear by this.
That's
cool. In Steamboat. So
I didn't realize they started in Steamboat.
Yeah.
The one down in Centennial Highlands Ranch. It's like two miles from my house. I still haven't been in there.
That's the one. Yeah.
Yeah, that's cool.
Yeah,
Lauren still goes there occasionally.
Yeah.
All right, so we have kind of a running composite, and you're training for Leadville 100. Are you doing anything else big this summer?
I'm doing a few races that that will prepare me for, help prepare me for Leadville 100. So I'm doing the Leadville Marathon again, and I'm also really excited to be running the Kendall Mountain Run in Silverton.
That looks fun.
And that one's on my birthday, so I'm really happy
that
I'm going to be in Silverton.
July?
Yes, July 22nd. And the week before Kendall Mountain Run, I am signed up to pace and volunteer for Hard Rock, which I've never been a part of. So
cool.
Super excited for that. What other races am I doing? I signed up for the Moab Marathon, and that's after Leadville 100.
It's
in November. It's pretty far out.
That's a good time to go to the desert. We always try to go to the desert in, like, early spring, late fall.
Yeah.
It's always nice. Okay, so let's change it up a bit.
Okay.
Riding, traveling. Let's talk about your writing. What are two or three of your favorite pieces that you've written to date? Yeah.
Ooh.
And really quick before you do that, morgantilton.com, right?
Yes.
Okay. I'll link that up. Just want to make sure.
Okay. And I try to upload stories onto my website, but I haven't had a lot of time recently to keep everything on there. I do try to share my stories on Facebook, though.
Okay.
So if you follow me on Facebook, you'll usually see my stories that have just gone live.
Nice. Favorites.
Well, one of my most favorite stories recently that I wrote was a story that I wrote for Men's Journal about a trip I took to the Copper Canyon last November. And I went with a brand called Health Warrior, and they started the first chia seed bar.
Oh, cool.
That's packaged in the U.S. And basically, they were inspired. So when they started their brand and their company, they were inspired by two books, Born to Run and The Omnivore's Dilemma.
Yeah.
And they had been wanting to find a way to give back to this community, the Tarahumara, or Rara Murray, in the Copper Canyon, that had inspired them to start their company, which is basically founded on this idea of living a really healthy lifestyle.
Yeah.
You know, if we're going to be, in our American culture, going to be working long hours and... and not have enough time to cook a meal at home, as a lot of Americans do, then the food that we bring on the go needs to be healthy. Excuse me. So they started a pilot program to reinvigorate the farming down in the canyon, because in the last 10 years, there's been a really horrible drought, and this has like continued to cause a lot of stress on the community down there. So I went with them to see if the pilot program worked.
Yeah.
And it did.
Yeah.
So what we found out was that chia seeds could be grown at this elevation in Yerike, which is also a town that's in the book Born to Run.
Yeah.
And I went down there, ended up meeting a handful of the Tarahumara, a handful of people who are actually in the book Born to Run, and befriending them on top of actually... learning and validifying that, okay, this farming initiative can work, and they wanted to replicate it. So they started a Kickstarter program. The story that I wrote tied back to this Kickstarter program. So now the Kickstarter program was a success, and those funds are going back directly to the farmers to replicate and get them all the equipment and the funding that they need to pay farmers. And I think the most wonderful part of this project is that the farming is owned by them. Like, the project is for them, and it's solely their choice what they do with the crop, whether they want to sell it, keep it for their families, if they want to... ship it internationally. It's up to them.
So they have the option to do.
Yeah, it's not owned by Health Warrior.
Is that a primary crop for that culture?
Chia seeds, yes. It's a very, very popular crop in Mexico in general. So Tarahumara are like the indigenous tribe of Mexico, and then there are also like Mexicans and mixed ethnicities. And so chia, in general, throughout Mexico, is a really popular crop. And so is corn.
Yeah.
And so are chilies.
Yeah.
So those are all crops that will be grown now as we continue to replicate the farming.
Did you get a run down there at all?
Yes.
Yeah?
Yeah.
How did you do some long days? What were you doing?
My days were pretty jam-packed, and I didn't have a ton of time down there.
Yeah.
I was interviewing a lot of people, and I got to go on one run.
Yeah.
And it was led by this really amazing person named Arnulfo, who is also a famous runner.
Yeah.
He's in the book Born to Run, and he is so kind. Yeah.
Cool.
Really, as are all the Tarahumara.
What's the takeaway? I don't know the answer to this, but what's the takeaway when you have a culture that lives healthy as a byproduct of their environment? Like, that culture, they have to be on foot a lot during the day, whether it's from farming or getting from community to community.
Right.
And they have to eat fresh, farm to table, because that's their only option.
Right.
So, by default, they're eating healthy. So, what's the takeaway for, I kind of have an idea, like, if they were placed into our culture, they probably wouldn't be quite as healthy. If we were placed in their culture, we'd have to be more healthy. What's the takeaway there, though? Like, do we just take some of the things from what they're doing, knowing that it's good for us, and try to implement it? Is that what Health Warrior's doing? Mm. You know, like, what's...
Yeah, that's a really, really good question. I think one thing that fascinates me related to that is keeping in mind that as strange as these cultural differences may seem to us and, like, how we may question them, that what we do is equally as strange to these other cultures, right? So they may not be able to imagine a world in which we literally train to run. They find that very bizarre. They don't actually run or train.
Yeah.
And a lot of people don't understand that. And what you said is totally spot on, that this, what we call a lifestyle, is their way of life. Their ability to run long distances is a byproduct of needing to walk in a really rugged environment through, you know, elevation gain and just from place to place, if a really far distance, and also the work that they do. They have movement in the work that they do day-to-day, farming. But also you can see that even in most recent years with the displacement that's happened as an effect of the drought and seeing tarahumara that have come into cities, that there's obesity that is happening. Because when you take any human and you remove movement and you have unhealthy habits, whether that's like what you're eating or drinking or a lack of exercise, then you're going to see the negative effects of that on the human body.
Yeah.
So our bodies evolve and adapt based off of our environments.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Of course, I believe that. I mean, my master's is in exercise science, so I mean that's the basis of the study.
Yeah, yeah.
But for the tarahumara, just a couple more questions because my brain's going like crazy.
Yeah.
Okay. So the drought obviously is affecting the farming and the sustainability of that farming in those communities.
Yeah.
But there are other factors that are affecting those communities. Like, there's violence, there's corruption, there's drugs that are affecting the communities. Even if the communities aren't necessarily taking place, you know, I know a lot of these bad people, the cartels, are shuttering their supply through parts of these lands. What happens based on that? But also, what would happen if one of, like, a program like what these guys are doing becomes really popular and shipping out chia seeds becomes really profitable?
Yeah.
Is that part of the mix? Like, would corruption delve into that? Because I'm assuming wherever money is there's going to be issues for some of these communities where there's not a lot of money in the first place. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does make sense. And I think that... I don't want to speak on behalf of Health Warrior because I haven't talked with them about what their plan is for, I guess, as they grow this program, how are they going to ensure the safety of the locals? But also, I'm not sure if it is their responsibility in the sense that they are giving the funds and the tools to these locals, which the locals, as I learned, they want this.
Yeah.
This is their choice. This is the way that they want to live. Like, this is enabling them to continue the lifestyle that they have been practicing and they want to continue to practice.
Yeah.
As far as my understanding about the locals and how they view living in a place that is interwoven with cartel and has been for decades.
Yeah.
I mean, this is not news, you know, like, it might be news to me because I saw it for the first time or learned about it for the first time in a news article that came out 5 years ago.
Right.
But these locals have been
dealing with
cartels for a long time. And that doesn't mean that it's, you know, a positive thing by any means, but I think that they've almost, like, learned to adapt. They've adapted within that. And I don't want to pretend like I understand what that means.
Yeah.
You know? Like, I haven't talked with them enough to know what if they have fear.
Yeah.
Or if they found a way to live almost like symbiotically with the cartel.
Yeah. That's interesting. I mean, my buddy, one of my good friends, he actually was RD for the Copper Canyon Ultras.
Okay.
A couple years ago, they had to cancel it because there's some crazy violent stuff.
The Caballo Blanco 50.
Yeah.
Which I learned and interviewed a lot of people about that race that was canceled.
Yeah.
And I think that there was a lot of negative news that came out about it that really impacted the race and put it in a bad light. One point of clarification is that the race it is open and inviting to internationals. It's also very much a local race.
Yeah.
And the Rava Murray, which is the Rava Murray, that's the actual name of the Tarahumara.
Okay.
So ethnically, that's what they're called, and they still call themselves that. They were called the Tarahumara by the Spanish conquistadors, and it means like the people with light feet, and they were the only ones that fled the conquerors, and so they got away. And
that's cool.
Yeah. So, anyways, the Rara Murray are the ones that they make up the majority of the racers, and they decided a few years ago when it was canceled, they still wanted to run it, and they did.
Yeah.
And it's actually continued to grow every year since then, and it grew again this year with more Tarahumara kids and adults coming out, walking from the canyons and coming in from Mexico, and there were over 1,000 kids this year.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, awesome. It was huge.
I think a lot of negative was from foreigners traveling and getting upset that it got canceled for the event. Wasn't that where a lot of the backlash has come from?
There were some mixed announcements that were going on at the race, as far as what I was told.
Right.
There are a few different groups of people that helped to organize the race, and there must have been some discord with the ultimate decision.
Right.
And what happened was they thought, okay, we should cancel the race. They made an announcement, and racers were probably surprised, shocked, scared, all these emotions. And that was, I believe, the day before the race was supposed to happen, maybe 2 days before, because there's celebrations that lead up to the actual Caballo Blanco 50. And then the Rara Murray, which don't say very much. They're not a people that really speak often or, like, approach what you would call controversy.
Right.
They stood up and they said, no, like, we want to race. We're here. We want to do this. And so the race organizers said, okay, we honor that. This is your race. We're going to let you race. And so they opened it up to the public to then race. And that caused a lot of confusion. And
that makes sense, though.
Yeah.
Okay. If you have to transplant yourself from your lifestyle right now into that lifestyle in the Copper Canyon, what would be the one thing that you would look forward to the most? And what would be the one thing that you would miss the most or not look forward to the most?
Like, if I were to totally adopt their way of
living. Like, from what you know right now, if you had to go live there, what would you look forward to the most? And what would you know that you'd miss the most?
I would look forward to working with the earth.
Yeah.
Yeah, having my hands in the dirt and I'm not saying farming is, it would be hard work, but just living off the land and falling in sync with it. I think it's something that I would really love to do at some point in my life, is live on property where I can grow my food and raise farm animals. And I would love that. And also the tightness of the community and the love that they share. They welcome their neighbors and just share whatever they have. And it's really a beautiful, beautiful way to live. I would miss... What would I miss? I would miss snow. I would miss playing in the snow, skiing, snowboard culture. It's just... it feels like a part of my blood. I've been doing it my whole life. So that's also what I missed in Italy, ultimately.
Colder weather.
I mean, if I lived in... if I were to go back and spend time like up in northern Italy in the Dolomites, I might feel, might have that access. But there's something about the culture.
Yeah.
The culture of skiing and snowboarding and the resorts we have here in the U.S. is just something that I really love.
Yeah, we're lucky. That's why I don't live in Florida anymore.
Yeah.
All right, so we touched on travel, touched on the running piece. Let's just talk about the writing a little bit, the creative process. I think that's interesting. What are a couple myths about being a freelance writer out there?
Oh, yeah.
It can be from the money that you make. It can be from the work, how much work you do, or how easy it is to get work. What are some myths out there? Or just, even if not myths, teach us about it a little bit. Like, what's it like, you know?
Yeah, it's a really romanticized career. And in a lot of ways, I am pursuing my dream career, and I don't see myself ever changing this. It does, I think it's funny, when I do travel writing projects and I go on a trip, a lot of people think, or at least the way they respond is, oh, wow, like, that's so cool, like, it's a vacation. Well,
no.
That's not actually true. It's not a vacation when I go on a trip that I'm writing about. A lot of times it's, I've been invited to go to a place. That's not all of my trips. It goes both directions. I do adventures that I plan and create on my own with collaborators, and then might pitch a story after. Or maybe I plan on just going on an adventure and not pitching a story at all. And then on the other end, I'm invited to go to places. For example, I went to Monterey Bay a year ago to spend 9 days in, and I was doing luxury travel, you know, tasting wine and going to vineyards and checking out like amazing restaurants, doing horseback riding on the beach, and it was really wonderful travel. It wouldn't have necessarily been like, it's not a trip that I'm the type of person that goes on like a backpacking trip when I have time off.
Yeah.
So it was like amazing travel, and I loved writing about it.
Yeah.
During that time, this is where the myth part comes in. I am usually running around like meeting from 7 a.m. to 10 p.m.
Yeah.
And then in order to keep up with all of my other projects and responsibilities, I'm usually waking up at like 3 a.m., 4 a.m., doing work at my laptop, then meeting up with the group, and then after we have had dinner, in which I've probably not had anything to drink, so that I can then go back to my room and work for a couple more hours, and then somehow survive off of 4 hours of sleep.
Yeah. Well,
all week.
You can't really procrastinate big writing projects. It just doesn't work.
No.
Any creative thing, though, but like writing especially, because it just takes longer. You know,
yeah.
It just takes longer.
Yeah.
What amount of your work do you go out and pitch and try to find somebody that is interested, and what amount do people approach you?
This has evolved a lot over the last 3 years. At first, when I started freelancing, I was, of course, pitching 100%. And now that I have these relationships established, as well as just my name being out among a lot of PR companies, I will have editors that I've worked with and former collaborators that I've worked with reach out to me and ask me to join a project or work on a story that they need. And I also get a lot of just press releases or pitches from PR companies. And I get them every day.
Yeah.
So now I have to intentionally be more selective with the projects I'm working on in order to have time to pitch, because for me, I love pitching.
Yeah.
It's actually one of my favorite parts of freelancing, and I hardly have time to do it anymore. It's like only...
Because those are your pet project. Like, those are your passion projects more often, right?
Yeah. And a part of that, too, is as you grow as a writer, then you... this also depends on like the type of writer that you are and whether you're interested in writing feature pieces, but I love long form writing, long narratives, and so I see myself like eventually I want to write those like 10,000 word pieces in magazines, and eventually, you know, then that progresses to writing a book. And right now I've been really working on those longer form stories.
Is there something you wouldn't write about?
That I would not write about in my life?
Is there something like... So here's a question in my mind. If if someone pitches to you and they give you X amount, there's nothing that somebody can pay you to write about or to open up a Pandora's box about. You know what I mean? Like, is there something that you just don't believe in discovering, or is there something that you're not interested in, like tech, for instance, or is like, you know, I'm trying to get.
Well, so I would say I'm more on the opposite end, that I'm a really like open door, open mind, and a learner.
Yeah.
And that's one reason why I love freelancing, is because I'm a student of my world, of the world around me.
Yeah.
And that I want to learn about anything and dive into all kinds of different topics. And in a way, I do. Like, my beat is in travel, in the outdoor industry, and in adventure. However, I also write like random blog posts for companies that sometimes reach out to me and want me to write about recycling.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, I'll write a blog about recycling for you, and I get to research that and dive into the latest recycling facts, just as a random example. But now I'm realizing, especially with having a passion for ultra running, which does take a consistent amount of time for me in order to maintain it, that I really have to be practicing the art of saying no.
Yeah.
Everyone talks about the art of saying yes, and that has been my way for my whole life, is like, yes, I want to try everything.
Yeah.
And I've done a lot of like really exciting new things in my life, you know, whether it's like going backpacking or skiing or trying a new activity, but now it's like I have to say no to a project, not necessarily because I don't believe in it or that I'm not interested in it, but because I have to be reasonable about the amount of time that I actually have.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah.
Do you have a creative process? Like, do you have to be in X spot doing Y? You know what I'm saying? Like,
yeah.
Do you?
No. I don't have a strict creative process. I am more like my days change.
Yeah.
Every day I'm in a new place. Like, here I'm with you in Denver at REI in a coffee shop, and
that one lady's loud, by the way. But anyway,
and,
the latte lady, she's getting after it.
The latte lady, yeah, exactly. But you know, later this summer when I go to run help at Hard Rock and then run Kendall, I'm going to be in Telluride for a week.
Yeah.
So when I'm there, I'm going to be working at my dad's office and at the library and at coffee shops. So I believe in, I guess for me, is just being disciplined and determined and passionate about what I'm doing, and then being adaptive within it.
Yeah.
So for me, sometimes it means waking up and just like drilling out and getting after writing really early, and sometimes it means like pushing into some late nights.
Yeah. I think it's important. You know, so many people want to be in the zone, they want to work into the zone, but if you can't get disciplined enough to just dive in and start working, you'll never get anything done. Like, me and Lauren learned that with kids. Like, we used to need 2 hours to get a freaking thing done.
Yeah.
If I have 10 minutes, like, I can get something done in 10 minutes.
Right.
You know?
Just being efficient with every second you have. Like, I have my laptop in my car just so I can like figure like, okay, get a deadline in before 4 p.m.
All right, there's one more question I had for you. Okay, for someone, myself, people listening, I think being a good writer is very subjective. I think most writers would agree with that as well. Consistency is probably as big as anything with a creative job, so being consistent is important. But what would be some basic journalistic rules? If I want to go to Leadville this year and figure out an angle or a story that I wanted to tell, what would be some rules for me as a writer? Like, what is there a simple, and I know you learned this in school, so it's like, it's probably easier for you to explain to me, but what would be a simple outline for people who are listening? There's young kids listening that want to go write, or if there's somebody who just has a book idea or an article idea who just can't get it on paper, what are some rules that can hopefully help facilitate that getting it to the paper, you know?
Yeah, I think first, do your background research.
Yeah.
So find 5 to 10 articles that have been written about the topic that you want to write about, and study those. Read about the people who are quoted in those stories. See what their backgrounds are. And then think about what hasn't been talked about yet. What can you add to the conversation? then when you're actually on the ground, make sure that you you talk to people who are involved and go to all levels. Don't be intimidated to go to the top. Go to the people who founded Leadville 100. They would love to talk to you. Hear from them what their stories are and take the time to, you know, prepare your questions in advance and go in with confidence and an open ear. Take notes, and you can also record it, especially with phones these days. I'm sure all the kids have phones. You can just record the conversation on your phone, and that way you have, like, you know, the credibility to back up what you're, the notes that you're taking, and you have, like, two sources of notes. You want to make sure that you write down what people are saying, but also write down what you're feeling and what you're seeing.
Yeah.
Like, what does the weather feel like? Is it humid? I mean, that detail might come back later in the story if, like, the person who was in first place at mile 97 suddenly had calf cramps that they, like, couldn't get through. This is all hypothetical, but...
Yeah. It's a good one.
And also, I have found it really helpful to document with even just, like, sound recordings of the environment or video or photographs just to jog my memory later.
That's a good idea.
Yeah.
I like that.
And then as far as getting this story placed, you can contact your local, you said newspapers, maybe also if there's a blog that the kids are reading that they're really... that they really admire, just reach out to the editors or the owners of those websites and newspapers and say, hey, I'm going to this event. I plan on writing about it, and introduce yourself.
Yeah.
And see if they're interested in a story. Don't go about actually writing the story before you contact them and have a confirmation that they want it, because editors don't really have time to read a full story.
Right.
Like, they'll let you know if they have space for it.
That's cool.
Yeah.
No, I think, of course, just get started. Like, get some stuff going before you do that. And people are going to want to make money when they start doing this stuff. I don't think that's necessarily the drill. You gotta figure it out a little bit, you know?
Yeah.
Seems like it makes sense.
Yeah, you do need to figure it out. And also, I think that if you want to start a business, you have to set those standards. And for me, one of the best pieces of advice I received from another freelance writer when I started was to not do any writing for free. And I think it's the same. I should say, I think the struggle is similar for photographers.
Yes.
I mean, photography is shared so easily these days, and I feel horrible being in the middle of that conversation, because a lot of times it's my responsibility to hand in photographs for a story, but I'm not a photographer. I mean, I am not a professional photographer in the sense that, like, I take photographs and I can edit them, and sometimes I do well, but if my primary focus is writing, you can't really do the best at all of these things at the same time, in my opinion. So the best photographers I know, it's like they charge for their photographs, and they should. And I really wish that editorial budgets had more depth to compensate for the quality of photographs that a lot of photographers make. So anyways, when I started writing, I would choose and accept projects that paid, even if it was $15.
Yeah.
You know, like, you kind of, we have to set the tone for ourselves as business owners that this is, you know, the way I make a living. This is how I pay my rent and get food.
Yeah.
So.
No, yeah, I mean, you gotta create value for your own craft. And if you're devaluing yourself, people pick up on that.
Yeah.
They want somebody who values themselves. And if you value yourself, then that's where the money comes from. Everything, you know, value is tied to money pretty consistently.
Yeah.
Interesting. Very interesting. All right, quick hitters. We're going to finish up with, like, quick sentence answers.
Okay.
Yeah. All right, so this question used to be amazing. It used to be the best question ever. But then certain things at the top have happened. The question used to be, if the president was coming to your house, what would you make them?
If what?
What would you be able to make them as a really good meal? So...
If who came? Sorry.
The president.
Wait, the president?
The question doesn't hold up anymore. So let's say that let's say that somebody that you really respect in the world, like Ernest Hemingway, is coming over to your house.
Okay.
He's back from the dead.
Yeah.
What would you be able to make from scratch for somebody that you really respected tonight? Best meal. Can you make anything?
Based off of what's in my fridge?
You can go. Well, you can go to the grocery store. Come on. Yeah.
Well, it depends on if they're vegetarian or not. I make a really good chicken breast.
Yeah?
Yeah. That you can. Yeah, no, it's really good. I've always had an oven where I've lived. I haven't always had, like, outdoor space with a grill. So when I go to my dad's house and he has a grill, we grill a lot. But, yeah, bake some chicken breast, and it's juicy, and I throw, like, this mix of cumin, turmeric, red chili pepper, salt, pepper, fresh garlic, like really just all of these rich flavors, and then just bake it perfectly so it's still moist and juicy, and then make like a smashed purple sweet potato mash, and then do like a mixed salad with radishes and tomatoes and sprouts and all and avocado and all the great veggies.
That's good. Ernest would be happy. Trump, he might not eat that, but that's okay.
He's, I don't want to eat with Trump.
He's not invited anymore. That's what I'm saying. The question lost its legs, so I have to like think of people that you might like. Okay, best place to go grab a beer in Telluride.
In Telluride?
Yeah.
Lost Dog.
Lost Dog?
Yeah.
What about in town? Do you have a favorite microbrewery here in town?
Oh, in town. That is a great question. I do enjoy beer, but just slight divergence. I actually really love live music. Yes. So the places that I go in Denver usually revolve around that. And my favorite place is called the Metal Lark, which is an underground bar. And no, the cocktails and the beer aren't that exceptional, but the music is.
Yeah.
Every single night, you will find a different genre. And Monday night jazz night is one of the most exciting, wonderful gems that I've experienced in this city. So much so that I had to stop going because you literally can't walk out the door until 2 a.m.
Oh my gosh.
Yep, throughout the night from 9:30 on, you have all of these incredible jazz musicians coming on and joining the stage and collaborating and doing these like spontaneous bouts of jazz. It's just one of the most beautiful, energetic experiences.
Yeah. Meadowlark. I haven't been, you know, I had kids about 6 years ago. I haven't been anywhere. What was the question? I usually keep my quick hitters in my back pocket. Cramping, what's worse for a runner? Cramping or chafing?
Chafing.
You think it's worse?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think you're right. Because cramping will eventually be gone, right?
Because cramping can go away, but chafing, man, it scars you for a few days. Jeez. It's like, give me the Vaseline for a week.
What's the next country you're going to travel to?
I have a couple, and probably going back to where I was. I'm probably going to go back to Copper Canyon this year, and I also want to go back to Italy and do some mountain running and also do some climbing with my brother in Finale Ligure.
Oh, very cool. Is he out there, or are you going to travel with him?
We would travel together.
Yeah. Since you're a writer and a runner and a traveler, we'll finish up with this. If I put $1 million on the table and I said you have to give me a title of the first book that you will write and publish, what would it be and what would it be about?
I think it would be something along the lines of A Beautiful Struggle.
Yeah.
And it would be somewhat of a memoir about challenges that I've had in my life and how I've embraced those and how it's made me who I am. Because I think through the struggles that each of us have, we have the ability to learn from those and to grow.
miles.
Yeah.
Sounds like an ultra running memoir.
Yeah, exactly.
People struggle.
That's awesome. Ultra running is the analogy for life.
It really is. It's awesome. Well, Morgan, thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. For sure. Appreciate it.
There you go. Morgan Tilton. Tons of cool stuff from all over the world. Hope you guys enjoyed that. Go to Athlete on Fire if you want to check out the show notes to get some links, morgantilton.com, as well as to listen to some upcoming shows. So we have an amazing athlete out of Canada who founded wheelwad.com. We also have Matt Frazier from No Meat Athlete coming up here in the next week or two. So stay tuned, and we really appreciate you guys listening.